my very favorite song we played in the band. Because I would be out front, and I was always uncomfortable being the front man, but I'd be singing and playing guitar. And then I would go back after about six songs and play drums for four or five, and we'd usually start with this one, and it's funky, and it's just fun, and my band was great, and Jimmy was in it.
Yeah. Sounds very fun.
Who sang?
Greg Hullab, my bass player.
He could do that?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
He had a tremendous voice.
Yeah. That's one of the scariest people to me to try to be like, to perform as, would be Stevie Wonder.
Guys like Greg, I mean, you have local rock stars like Jimmy and my buddy Mark Quinn and Gagnepain and people like that. And Greg was never heralded like they were, but he was like a musician's musician. His dad was a jazz pianist.
Okay.
And he said, if you always want to have a job, play the bass. And so he played the bass and he sang like an angel and he was the easiest guy to be in a band with. Those are like... And that's what his job was, being a musician.
Huh.
Yeah. I was really lucky. Speaking of lucky, tomorrow is my mom's birthday, and Rach went into the Wayback Machine, and she found about a 10-minute interview that she and Tony Colombo did with my mom about 4 years ago when I was celebrating my 20th anniversary in radio, and it was really... so much more emotional than I expected because she played it in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And just hearing my mom's voice when she was all completely good and, you know, no signs of dementia and hadn't fallen and wasn't in any hospital. Like, I had forgotten.
Yeah.
So we're going to play that tomorrow.
And it's also, you guys should definitely listen to this if you didn't hear it back whenever it aired. But listen again, because I remember at the time thinking, like, this is so sweet. I'm really glad.
It was really sweet.
We did this interview. And it just now it just hits home so much
harder. It really does. Yeah. It was really, really nice. We'll play that for you tomorrow at about 4 p.m. And let's see. Rage is going to be gone, flying out September 11th back to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You've been a couple of times now. Do you feel like you're kind of going, not home, but like it's no longer intimidating for you?
Yeah, it's definitely not as intimidating.
How about any stratagems for flying 50 hours?
Well, it'll only be about combined, like maybe 30, because it's like 13 from Dallas to there. And, you know, anyway, my new strategy is just to rely on all of the wonderful luxuries and conveniences that we have for traveling in 2024.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels silly to complain about it at this point.
Right.
Because all I have to do is sit there. I'm not flying the plane. So all I have to do is watch, you know, Netflix on my phone or try to catch up on work or all this other stuff. In the past, I've been so anxious to fly, and now I've gotten a lot more used to it. I'm like, I should just lean into the fact that it's just like sitting in on my couch for 13 hours. I just can't move as much.
Yeah, I was going to say, without being able to lay down.
I can't stretch out, but...
Do you have a whoobie? Like a little...
No, they give you, for the international flights like that, they do give you a blankie. Like a thin little fleece blanket.
Do you or Kurt use like one of those neck pillows or anything?
He bought me from Temu. So it wasn't like the original turtle neck pillow. Mm-hmm. So maybe you've seen these. It like rests on your neck and then you can just kind of like tilt your head. So there's the turtle brand of that. And then there was the Temu brand. That's what we got because we didn't want to pay like $80 for it. It kind of works, but I think I'm just going to go with the pillow they give me on the flight.
Yeah.
I don't want to bring too much stuff to make myself comfy because then I have to lug it around Japan. So just go on with as few stuff as possible. We actually do the whole trip with just a duffel bag and like a crossbody bag.
Nice.
We don't check anything.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Yeah, it's fun.
What are you most excited about this trip?
I'm always most excited to eat because it's the best food in the world, I think. And I'm really excited to travel outside of Tokyo. We're going to go to Kanazawa, and that's just going to be a nice, like, a little bit more rural situation and obviously a much smaller town. Tokyo is the biggest city in the world. And just have, like, a couple of days of really quiet time out there. I think that's going to be really cool.
I can say this. I can say anything because I'm from South Roxana. I can say anything at all. And if someone's like, well, aren't you an elitist looking down on people? I'm like, let me take you to 1403 Wilson Street. But... You should be very proud and pleased. A girl from Grafton has her own show on KMOX, and you've been to Japan 3 times.
Yeah, it sounds very cool on paper, doesn't it?
It does.
That's because it's cool in real life.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's pretty neat. It doesn't like sink in all the time, but it's pretty sweet. Like, yeah. Like I said, it feels, you know, I'm trying to have like a mindset shift in general in my life, because I just realized like I am so lucky, and most of us are so lucky. Like most people listening now, like we have great lives. We have a roof over our heads. We have a home to go home to. Like that's huge. And then when you add on the blessings on top of that, I'm just like, I shouldn't complain about stuff. It's silly to complain.
Razor's edge.
Absolutely. So I found a TikTok, since we were talking about TikTok last hour, of a young lady posing a question to us older people.
Older people, what did you do before you could look something up? Like, if you saw someone and you were like, oh, they remind me of that actor. What was that? What's his name? Like, and you couldn't, and none of your friends knew. Would you go to a library? Like, okay, without Google Maps, like, I know that there was MapQuest, but before that, like, genuinely, what would you do? Would you just accept not knowing? Like, I would, please stitch this and tell me, because I genuinely do not understand how I would survive.
Can I answer this one?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Here's what I don't remember. I remember trips, and you'd have the big map. And dad would be yelling at mom. I remember that. But like, if I were going to someone's house from South Alexander to Rosewood Heights or Kendall Hill, and someone's like, I live at 123 Maple Street, I have no idea how we found it. I just don't remember. I do remember people saying, like, take a left at the yellow mailbox and go until you see a big dog. Like, that was our map quest back then. I don't know about other people my age, but I don't have a great memory of how I would find a new girlfriend's house or a buddy's house or a party. Like, how the hell did you find it?
What about you, Wheels?
Well, you grew up. I grew up. You memorized everything. Like when you're learning to drive, like
that's a good point.
You know, my dad would be like, "Hey, remember this? This is Merriman. This is Middle of. They run parallel, 5 miles, 6 miles." Of course, where I lived, it was stupid because the roads were literally 1 mile apart and named 5 miles, 6 miles, 7 mile, 8 mile. So it wasn't really hard to figure out. But like going through someone's neighborhood, it would just be like, "Yeah, you turn left here, and then turn right at the second street, and it's the third house on the left." And you just either remember it or you write it down. And then if you got things wrong, you just got things wrong.
Yeah.
Like that's the
first
thing. You
just didn't show up on time.
And that was the first thing that I thought of just for that general question, because she's talking about like if you can't place a face to a name on a movie or whatever, you just, you're just okay being wrong.
Yeah.
You just be, well, maybe I'm right, maybe
we
I'm wrong.
Lower standards for accuracy.
Right. If you knocked on the wrong door when you're going somewhere, you're like, well, gotta step back and go back and find my way.
Dave, that's really interesting that you said we had lower standards for accuracy, because I actually think the opposite. I think we had higher standards for accuracy. We just had way more humility in saying, I don't know. Mm. Whereas nowadays, it's like, it's almost like admitting defeat if you say, I don't know, because you have all these different things that you can look up and you can think you know the answer and you think you know what's going on. And most things, you know, if it's like, oh, who won the World Series in this year? That's not
the crash rate for 16-year-old pilots.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But other things, there are some things that we can't know for sure. And people have different versions of the truth. And I'm not going to be the judge and jury and say like, no, this is the ultimate truth. But so many people are comfortable being like, no, I know for a fact. I know for a fact. And I think part of it is just we're used to that instant gratification of knowing. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, we were more accustomed to saying like, I don't know. I guess I'll figure that out, or maybe I'll find it out someday.
This dovetails nicely into a topic I had. I saw a discussion online about why kids don't need to learn the way that we learned by memorizing things. Because let's face it, we mostly memorized facts. Like when I was in law school, I was taught how to look up the law. That's a bit different, and taught how to think like a lawyer. But when you're in grade school, middle school, high school, you're memorizing facts. War of 1812, this. The 14th president was this. And they were making the argument that they literally don't need to do that anymore. If you understand what a war is and you understand what a president is, if someone asks you a fact about it, you can look it up and you can know it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's not important to learn it and memorize it because it's at your fingertips.
Yeah, we should be learning more context and underlying facts than just dates and events. We should be like, why did that happen? What's the cause of it? You know, as opposed to in 1892, this happened. Remember that. Well, the emphasis should be on the meaning of something and not the date.
Yeah, but don't you think, you know, isn't it important to know off the top of your head that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492? Like, to have a really good idea of when that happened, as opposed to like, oh, it happened sometime in the past, maybe the 1800s. You know what I'm saying? Like,
but we, in that context of we can look it up.
Yeah.
As opposed to, this is, guys, this is what I'm getting into the shift in the ideas. If you can look something like that up in 1 second, if you could just go, hey, I don't want to say Siri's name too close to a command because I don't want to set off anybody's phone.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, when did Columbus sail for, you know, the Americas? That I can have that answer in 2 or 3 seconds. But if I want to understand the actual, like what it means, I think that's what should be taught more rather than memorization of dates and things. So I'm not saying you don't need to know it, and I'm not saying there's no value in knowing it. I'm saying that in a time when you can just look it up instantaneously on your phone, we should spend more time on the hows and the whys and the what it means.
Also, as someone who is definitely a generalist, I'm not an expert in anything, but I have a pretty good shallow puddle breadth of a lot of knowledge. I'm just kind of like a sponge that way. I think that's a good thing. I think it's good to have meaningless facts, not so you can show off at a bar, but just so you know stuff, as opposed to being an empty vessel that can be filled by Google. I think that's very different.
Yeah, I think where I'm getting at is different.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Like, more about the meaning of an event as opposed to the facts and figures of the event.
Right. So, like, part of the reason why it's interesting to me when we're talking about things in school, like doing math long-handed now, does that even matter? I mean, I guess it could, right? Because in the world where all electricity goes away and you don't have calculators or computers anymore, somebody needs to know how to do things by hand. I guess if you're preparing for that type of disaster, it might be helpful. But in practical reality, do you need to be able to do math long-handed?
Yes, you do, because you don't want to always have to, like, if something like long division, like, you should be able to do that. You shouldn't
have
to always
reach
for
your phone. I don't need to know. I don't need to know how to do.
Wish somebody told me that.
I've never needed to use any of the things I learned in algebra or pre-calculus in my day-to-day life.
But you do use you would sometimes go like, okay, you solve for X without realizing it, I'm sure.
Yeah. What I'm saying, though, is
it's valuable to know, like, I don't know. I disagree with the whole, like, oh, we shouldn't even, I'm not saying you're saying we shouldn't teach the kids math because we have calculators.
Oh, no, we should, for sure.
But I think there is a lot of value in, like, if you want to learn calculus, like, yes, of course. I don't think there should be any shortcuts there.
Well, no, you have to if you're going to pursue certain things.
Right.
Right? I mean, if you're going to do anything
with
science or whatever.
But I'm fine with every kid learning Algebra 1 in high school or something. I think it's valuable to take that step and go like, okay, is this for me? I think keeping that as a standard is fine.
Good point.
Andrew?
I don't like algebra.
Thank you. There's just no one like Stevie.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
One off.
Did you see him perform at the DNC?
I did.
He did a great job.
Yeah.
Still got it.
The We Are the World documentary. What was that called again, Rach? I know you watched it. I can't remember.
I feel like it was just called We Are the World.
Was it something like that? But I mean,
you mean like the greatest night in pop.
Something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was one of the guys there that everybody was like, "Oh my god, it's Stevie Wonder."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure.
Like everybody was like, "Oh my god, it's Stevie."
Yeah, and wasn't it like Bob Dylan was really struggling to sing his part, and they brought him over to Stevie,
and he just made him
feel comfortable.
Yeah, because Bob Dylan was intimidated by everybody else, because I think the way they described it is he felt like he wasn't a good enough singer to be with these other people.
He wasn't.
No. He's not. His singing was never really his strength, right? He had a unique sound which made him. But he was struggling with it really badly, and it kind of gave him some Stevie time, and that got him to the point where he was good to go.
Yeah. Here's one of the weirder topics I'll bring up. You know, I'm fascinated by the brain and consciousness and how it works and memory and all this kind of stuff. And I was watching the Cardinals pregame the other day, and Pegnazzi brought up Todd Zeal. So Todd Zeal was a catcher / third baseman, I don't know, in the 80s or 90s or something.
Yeah, 90s.
And I am quite positive that I have not thought of Todd Zeal in 30 years. And as soon as I said his name, I had him. I had his face. Mm-hmm. I had his body. I had the basics of his career. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's weird to me that there's a cell in my electric meat up there, my little gelatinous, you know, 4-pound brain, that a part of it is dedicated to Todd Seal.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's weird, too, when you're like, oh, it's on the tip of my tongue. I can't think of what it is. Mm-hmm. I can't think of what it is. And then it comes to you. It's like, oh, that actually worked.
Yeah.
It's so strange
it's
how the
so
brain
weird.
Works.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of those random things in there from sports. Just a lot of random names. And I see the name. I'm like, oh, my God.
I'm like that with the Bravo Real Housewives. You give me pretty much anyone and I've got some stats on them. Tons of worthless information.
Speaking of worthless information, this fascinated me. This was on a TikTok. The border between Canada and the United States, I think it's the longest border in the world. It's like 8,000 miles or something like that. Did you know that there's an actual 20-foot wide border? It's called the slash line, and they did it, I don't know, in the before times, and it's just 20 feet, it's 20 feet wide, and it goes the entire length through all of the forests of Canada and the United States up north, and they maintain it, and it costs a bunch of money to maintain it, and you know, weeds grow, and trees pop up, and they knock them down. Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
That for 8,000 miles or something nonsensical like that, we have an actual 20-foot wide border.
I wonder if anyone's ever tried to like build a house that's
in the middle of it?
Yeah, like a house that is like partially in America and partially in Canada.
It's the least guarded border in the world.
Hmm.
Oh, okay.
Like if you want to cross, you can 100% cross.
Do they have like immigration complaints?
Wheels,
up
you
there?
Probably.
Oh, I mean, well, we just did it. We didn't just like go into the wilderness and cross because there was water, but we used to cross all the time to go to Canada. We'd go there for sporting events. We'd go there. When you turn 18, you go there. Do you go to the strip clubs? Because
hey.
You could be 18 and get in, so all the high school kids, when you're 18...
I was like, at least he's not going to say
visual.
Strip club.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
I thought he was going to say gentleman's club.
Well, you could also go to the regular bars, because the drinking age was 18 also. So a lot of people would do that. We'd go to Don... Do you know Don Cherry? The big mouth guy that has been a hockey analyst forever.
Yeah.
He had a sports bar there. Everybody go there and watch hockey. Yeah.
Sounds fun.
It was.
Welcome back, guys. DGS 234. My next guest is Ivor Davis. He is the author of The Beatles and Me on Tour in 1964 when he was just a young lad, a reporter for the London Daily Express. He accompanied the guys on a 34-day, 24-city tour, spent a lot of time with them in private, got to know them, and he is my guest now. Ivor, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you, Dave.
So everyone's a Beatles fan. I was a huge, huge Beatles fan. As a musician, it was probably, I was born in 1964, and I was probably 1981 before I listened to any band but the Beatles. I was just so dedicated to them and the old stuff, the new stuff. So I'm really interested to talk to you about this. My first question is, did you realize at the time, Ivor, how momentous this was, or did it take some time to really settle in?
The answer to that is very simple. I did not have a clue. I did not ever think that 60 years later, and it's 60 years when they first hit America, that we would be talking about the Beatles. I mean, neither did the Beatles. Brian Epstein, their manager, said they're going to be as big as Beethoven. I think they've always become bigger than Beethoven. So the answer to your question is no way, and nor did they.
That is so amazing and charming. I guess the fact that they didn't consider themselves a big deal back then gave you access to get to know them as just people, right?
Yes. I mean, don't forget, they were very nervous about America. They knew that if they conquered America, and believe me, they did 60 years ago this month, they did. When I talked to them, years later, I talked to them. I was in Liverpool. They weren't there, but there were 10,000-15,000 people at the Beatles International Week in Liverpool from all over the world, brought together by our new family, our family with John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Mm-hmm. It's still, every time I think about it, and you ask me a question, I'm boggled, if you like. I'm surprised. And yet, I don't think, I mean, the Rolling Stones, who else is really big? But the Beatles are kings.
So take yourself back to 1964. You're a young man, probably a music fan. And the one thing about the Beatles is they absolutely reinvented rock and roll. So it's not as if you even had any context for what they were doing. Did it appeal to you personally? Did you really love the music from the start, or was it just so different?
You know what it was? It was pure, unadulterated luck. I mean, I was a foreign correspondent for the London Daily Express in 1964 when my editor called me from London and said, the boys are coming, get on the plane, go to San Francisco, join them. You'll be writing George Harrison's column for him. And I vaguely knew who the Beatles were. I was not a music expert. I'd seen them on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 1964. I and 74 million people tuned in. But that's all we knew. But don't forget, Dave, the key thing is this was in 64, 60 years ago, when we didn't have the internet, and when if you sneezed in St. Louis, within 10 seconds, I'd hear about it in California.
Yeah.
So I hope that answers your question. Not a bloody clue.
Wow. Wow. What, you know, you get put with people on a trip for whatever reason, and you get to know them pretty quick. You're sharing your life with them. Did you like them right away? Were they approachable? Were they nice guys?
Well, don't forget, when I first came on the scene on the first day of the tour, they were always wary of newcomers because they didn't know. But I had no ulterior motive. I was going to report on these guys. See how they did. Within 24 hours, we hit it off, and I became almost like part of the family. I mean, my room was next door to their suite. I'd go in there and raid their mini bar, help myself to drinks, much to the chagrin of Brian Epstein, who kept complaining that that their drink bill was too high. Mm-hmm. And within 2 days, we were the same age. We grew up in a similar circumstances. I in London during World War II. They in Liverpool during World War II. So right away, we hit it off. They knew I wasn't out to get them, and it was a terrific journey.
Let's go Beatle by Beatle. And if you would, just freeform for me, like a memory of them. And let's start with John, who is always my favorite Beatle. What when you think of John Lennon, is there a time, a moment, a line, an incident that really pops into your head?
John Lennon was a cheeky bugger, okay? John Lennon loved to needle you. I love John Lennon because he was the most provocative guy to talk to. I mean, if he met you, he'd say, oh, you're Dave Glover the lover. You're the lover boy, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, that's what he did. He prickled people, he provoked people, and he hoped to get the reaction out of them. And, you know, I didn't go for it. So without finishing up on John, my name is Ivor. And he kept calling me Ivan the Terrible. He had a friend in Liverpool, a good friend called Ivan, and it was always Ivan the Terrible. And after the first 3 days, I gave up telling him what my name was. And that was John. Very funny, very witty, very sharp. Paul McCartney. Well, sorry, can I go on to Paul?
Please, yeah.
So Paul McCartney was always, and there's a word I always say, it's an Irish word, it's a Yiddish word, called schmoozer. I mean, he could butter you up. I mean, when we got on their private jet, and Paul would come along and say, do you want your usual Ivor, gin and tonic? I would say, yes, give me the gin and tonic, but a little less tonic and a bit more gin, you know. So that was him. And he was, I mean, look at him today. He's incredible. He's the richest rock star in the world. And he keeps on touring. So who have we got left? We got George. Okay. George Harrison was a bit of a taciturn guy. He didn't have much to say. He was a bit PO'd because the Beatles never gave him all the songs.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the way George emerged on his own as a brilliant songwriter and a star. So that was George. And my problem was I had to talk to him about the column. But he went to bed about 3 in the morning, woke up 2 in the afternoon. My deadline was 3 in the afternoon. So for the first, the first couple of weeks, I made up the column. And then George confronted me and said, Ivor, my mother in Liverpool says he'd been reading the column supposedly by me, and it is a bunch of shite, which is a nice way of saying it.
Yes.
So that was George. Ringo was kind of in the background. He never sang much. He played the drums. But again, Ringo emerged in his own right when they broke up. So in a way, the breakup was very valuable for them all because they all showed what they do. Now, Ringo, I saw on its birthday in July, and he's looking fantastic with a little help from the cosmetic makeup men.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And he's touring, and Paul is touring, and they are pretty formidable even today.
So with the Beatles, you had the individual human beings, and then you had Beatlemania, which was something that no one on earth had ever seen before or even contemplated as a possibility. I remember being a kid and watching A Hard Day's Night, and when I saw them being chased by the girls, I'm like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a Beatle. What was that like to live through?
Well, A Hard Day's Night was the best Beatle film in my mind. The second Beatle film wasn't that great. I mean, it showed you the craziness. I mean, people trying to cut pieces of Ringo's hair, being chased through the streets, trying to get a little bit of peace and quiet. And it was a perfect example of the way it was. And that's the way it was during their touring years. And I must say that I think by the time you got the Beatles in St. Louis, they were ready to hang up their guitars. They'd had enough. They were fed up because people were coming along to see them, only to see them, not to hear their music. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, Dave, back then, the sound systems were crappy. Mm-hmm. You couldn't hear what they were singing. You know, Ringo didn't know what song they were singing. And the systems were appalling. Today, of course, they're brilliant.
Yeah, my sister was able to go see the Beatles in St. Louis, and that's what I remember her saying is, and I've seen like the Shea Stadium and documentaries on it, and they were great musicians, 10,000 hours in Hamburg, and they took it seriously, and as a musician, I can't even imagine when you can't hear your monitors, and you're just looking at each other for clues. Let's talk about Brian Epstein a bit. You don't hear as much about him. What was your relationship like? What was he like as a person?
Before I do, I want to blame your sister for the concerts because she screamed and she screamed and so did 17,000 other young women and I couldn't hear a bloody word. Okay, I've knocked your sister already. I apologize. So go ahead. Sorry, what was the question again about Brian? Oh,
yeah,
Brian.
What was he like?
Brian was a very, a kind of bit of an uptight guy. Because he was the guy that tried to keep them in line. He was the one that would say to John, don't talk with a cigarette in your mouth. Because the Beatles, if you look at the pictures, they had ciggies in their mouth wherever they were.
Mm-hmm.
And he would get on stage and he would tell them, John, don't put your hand in your pocket. John, behave. And he cleaned them up and he put them, you know, to the way that people saw them in those lovely tight suits and ties and mop head haircuts. And he was really, I mean, he really was a genius behind re-showing them. The makeover was Brian's responsibility. Unfortunately, he died too young. He was a bit of a warrior and, that and all and drugs and all the rest of it. When Brian died, the Beatles broke up. He was their headmaster. He was in charge of them. He kind of wrapped them on the knuckles and could get away with it. He was a great guy, and he was really... I mean, I just came back from Liverpool a few days ago, and 10,000 people came to Liverpool, and they now have a statue of Brian Epstein in Liverpool.
Very cool. Very cool. Ivor Davis is the author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. Ivor, this has been a complete treat for me. Really fun. I can't wait to read the book. Thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us here in St. Louis.
Thank you very much, and give my regards to your sister.
Hey. you guys wish you could have all of your musical experience and knowledge erased and washed away and start all over again and hear all this stuff for the first time?
Ooh. No.
Oh, I do. But I'm less of a new music listener than Wheels, so yeah. It kind of makes sense that it's like, because sometimes I'll be looking for something to listen to, and I'm just like, I've exhausted all of my options.
I feel you. Yeah, I'm more like
join
that
me.
Too.
Let's go. I can get you some metal.
I'm open to new music. It's just very rare that I hear something and then I'm like, ooh, I'm going to go download that. You know, it's way more so with like pop music. I can get into that, but like new rock music and stuff, I just don't really hear it.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing. Like all pop is a little different because pop tends to be of a certain formula. Because they know beats per minute. They know what people like over time. So they're following formulas. If I follow like hip hop or rock, they seem to evolve in many different ways. So what used to be at the root is now no longer. Now there's 10 branches that have come from that and they all sound a little different.
Yeah. Although I think every genre has formulas.
Yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying like, but the ones that work to make song, not just, I don't mean the brand of pop, but like, what becomes popular is you know certain topics, you know certain beats per minute, you know certain length, all of those things play well on the radio, right? Just like as in sports, football plays better on TV than baseball does. It fits the screen better. It works better. So people kind of know how those things go. But when it comes to specific targets, whether it's R&B, hip-hop, rock, whatever, if you started somewhere 25 years ago, that style is not being played now.
Yeah.
There's 10 different ones that have come out of that.
It really is. Music is so much, so analogous to the, when you look at hominids and Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons and ancient man, and this one led to this one led to this one led to this one, that you don't have modern humans without those guys. And you don't have any bands without those guys.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
I mean, there's a little bit of Muddy Waters in Metallica.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.